6640.
Your future lies in 6640.
66 books by 40 authors, and yet we now discover it's an integrated message system from outside our time domain.
Welcome to 6640, Chuck Missler's daily program connecting the Bible to your life and the world around you. It's God's plan that began before time, and it's your future. It's a plan that includes you. Now here's the host of 6640, John Leffler.
You frequently hear the concept that we are addicted to oil. Well, that's sort of like saying we're addicted to our own blood or something like that. No, oil right now is the energy by which the entire global economy moves. Oil, natural gas, those are the two large sources of energy. There are some other ones, but for transportation, that's pretty much it. And contrary to a lot of the pronouncements about alternatives, the alternatives are not ready to go. So oil is going to be our source of energy for the next 20 years at least. So what does that mean? Welcome to 6640. Yesterday on the program, Dr. Chuck Missler began a series entitled Weathering the Coming Storm. We're talking about geopolitical storms, economic storms, and very tied to that are energy storms. Because number one, our energy comes from largely parts of the world that are right now in a certain amount of turmoil, with that turmoil only growing, and that affects the global price of energy. But number two, some of those parts of the world, namely Saudi Arabia, the oil fields are going level. They're not able to produce more. They're actually in decline. And on a daily basis, the increasing demand on a daily basis is beginning to outstrip the daily supply. We've literally, in many cases, painted ourselves back into an energy corner. And what happens in energy affects economics and will tie in with coming monetary crises that we know we're going to see in this decade as well. So what does all of this mean? We began the series yesterday by saying, all right, we know that there are a series of rather intense storms coming, but how does God want us to deal with that in terms of either preparation or spiritual approach in any other way that we need to? He's our source and provision, and that's what this whole series is all about. Dr. Chuck Missler begins the series today looking at energy, where it comes from, and the situation that's going on in that part of the world as he continues the series, Weathering the Coming Storm.
So you need to understand Iran really controls the southern third of Iraq, where most of the key oil sites are. And they, of course, are adjacent to Saudi Arabia, okay? So the influence has spilled across the border to southern Iraq, obviously, and that's where the supergiant oil fields are. There's also a key border with Shia Islam's mortal enemy, Saudi Arabia, which is Sunni. Understand, Saudi Arabia is Sunni, Iran is Shiite. Now, the total control of is the Hormuz oil checkpoint in the Persian Gulf and also the new power in Iraq. And so this the Strait of Hormuz is a crucial strategic point. It has almost total control of the Strait of Iran has almost total control of it. It is the tight waterway that connects the Persian Gulf to the Mediterranean. Over 17 million barrels of oil have to pass through Hormuz every day. And over 40% of all the oil shipped in the world, in other words. 90% of all the daily oil shipments from the Middle East go through there. With Hormuz alone, Iran would cripple the world overnight. That's why we have super carriers going there. That's why we have mine-hunting submarines going through there and so forth. And so today, Iran backs the Shiite militants in Iraq. They give them money and guns. Why do they do that? Because gaining control of Iraq takes the Iranians one step closer in their ambitions for revenge against who? Against Saudi Arabia. Now let's shift down to the south of Saudi Arabia and look at Yemen. That's at the other tip, south. And the Pentagon has just tripled its budget on Yemen. Even ABC News called Yemen the next top target in the terror war and a near-perfect haven for terrorists. And Obama just sent Yemen U.S. troops, ships, and weapons. And so Yemen might be a failed country with a collapsing government, shrinking oil supply, exploding population, and not much of anything else but one thing, and that is position. They also have a critical choke point. They call on the tip of the Arab Peninsula. It's a place called Bab el Mandeb, and it means the Gate of Tears. And it also is a choke point for oil shipments, and again, under Shiite control. And so the most oil states on the Red Sea cannot get a drop of oil without shipping it through Bab el Mandeb. and over 3.3 million barrels go through it every day. So Iran has been investing in proxies, if you will, over the last 6 years. Yemen is being one of them. And the billion that Tehran now donates every year to the Hezbollah terrorists in Lebanon, and the billions they give Syria's Shiite president to build cement factories, car factories, and so forth, is all Iran becoming Iran proxies. And in return, Iran gets the Hezbollah's Arab-speaking terrorists to run militant Shiite training camps in Iraq, and gets Syria to distribute Iran's money and weapons to others that are part of the game. So the secret money that they send to the rebels in Yemen could have a payoff too, because it opens up a backdoor access to Saudi Arabia again. The people that are trembling tonight are the Saudis, for a lot of good reasons. And the Yemen's rebels have already hit towns across the Saudi border. The Saudis have hit back, losing dozens of troops in the process. But we're just seeing the opening innings of this one. And but even a nuclear bomb is only a beginning. Even if the go-ahead to build a nuke never comes from Iran's top cleric, the more immediate danger is a wildfire of Shiite-Sunni unrest starting in Iran's new hotbeds of Shia support and spreading across the rest of Sunni-run oil states, with the richest oil fields in the world's richest oil nation as the final battleground. That's Saudi Arabia. And as you watch all this, don't lose sight of the fact that the guy in the White House is a practicing Sunni Muslim. It's astonishing how many people do not realize that. As we talk, big and small Gulf states are piling up weapons, stocking anti-missile batteries, sandbagging their oil terminals, ports, and water desalination plants. Abu Dhabi alone has already bought $17 billion worth of U.S. anti-missile hardware. And the Arab Emirates and Saudi Arabia just splurged on weapons to the tune of another $25 billion. This is big money. As we talk, U.S. F-16 fighter jets, Patriot missile systems, giant cruisers, and several thousand more U.S. troops are quietly digging in for an epic fight that could spread past Iraq and Yemen, even into Qatar, the United Arab Emirates, and Bahrain. Leaders in all three America's biggest Middle East allied countries, Egypt, Jordan, and Saudi Arabia, all claim that the epic Sunni-Shiite showdown is in the cards. So this is something else you won't read in your media. In fact, most people aren't briefed enough to even understand the tension here. Over recent months, the U.S. has doubled the number of its Avenger-class mine hunters in the region to 8, as well as deploying more MH-53 mine-sweeping helicopters and remotely controlled submersible mine hunters. And that's all a fairly sensitive issue, obviously. It has deployed the USS Ponce, a converted transport ship for housing special forces, and is keeping 2 aircraft carriers on station at all times, and those are big aircraft carriers. The U.S. also has been boosting the missile defenses of its Gulf allies. No matter how it starts, Saudi Arabia will be a key focus. Not only is Saudi Arabia home to Mecca, Islam's holiest place, it's also home to the corrupt and U.S.-allied Royal House of Saud, considered an insult to all Islam. Iran is getting ready to assert its place in the world. Think Japan or Germany in the 1930s. The parallels are interesting. The threat is there, it's large, and it's not going away. So that's another overlay on our world. And on this, I think there's another deceit of our time. We live in the age of deceit, and I think it's important for us to really identify the deceptions that we're victims of. And one of them that's promoted almost daily in most corrupt media is Islam is a peaceful religion. That's a lie on several counts. First of all, Islam is not just a religion. It's a complete total system of life. It has its religious, legal, political, economic, social, and military components. That's a far different creature than you would think of just somebody that has a different theological belief. And Islamization begins where there are sufficient Muslims in a country to agitate for their religious privileges. When politically correct, tolerant, culturally diverse societies agree to Muslim demands for their religious privileges, some of the other components tend to creep in as well. As long as the Muslim population remains around or under 2% in any given country, they will, for the most part, be regarded as peace-loving minority, not as a threat to other citizens. And that's the case that we see in the United States, Australia, Canada, China, Italy, and Norway, and so forth. From 2% to 5%, they begin to proselytize from other ethnic minorities and disaffected groups, often with major recruiting from the jails and among street gangs. This is happening in Denmark, United Kingdom, Germany, Spain, and Thailand. From 5% on, they exercise an inordinate influence in proportion to their percentage of the population. For example, they will push for introduction of halal, that's their food restrictions, thereby securing food preparation jobs for Muslims. That's occurring in Switzerland, Philippines, Sweden, Netherlands, Trinidad. These are all in the 5 to 8% kinds of range. When the Muslims reach 10% of the population, they tend to increase lawlessness as a means of complaint about their conditions. In Paris, we've seen the car burnings. Any non-Muslim action offends Islam and results in uprisings and threats, such as Amsterdam, and with opposition to Muhammad cartoons and films about them. You've seen all this in the news. Such tensions are seen daily, particularly in Muslim sections in Ghana, Kenya, India, Russia, and Israel. After reaching 20%, nations can expect hair-trigger rioting, jihad militia formations, sporadic killings, and the burnings of Christian churches and Jewish synagogues, such as occurs in Macedonia, Ethiopia, and others. At 40%, nations experience widespread massacres, chronic terror attacks, and ongoing militia warfare, such as in Bosnia, Chad, and Lebanon. From 60%, nations experience unfettered persecution of non-believers of all other religions, including non-conforming Muslims, sporadic ethnic cleansing, genocide, use of Sharia law as a weapon, and jizya, the tax placed on infidels, such as occurs in Malaysia, Albania, Sudan, Qatar. After 80%, expect daily intimidation and violent jihad, some state-run ethnic cleansing, even some genocide, such as these nations drive out the infidels and move toward 100% Muslim, such has been experienced and in some ways is ongoing in Bangladesh, Egypt, Gaza, Indonesia, Iran, Iraq, Jordan, Morocco, Pakistan, Syria, Tajikistan, Turkey, and the United Arab Emirates. It is also important to understand that in some countries with under 100% Muslim population, such as France, the minority Muslim populations live in ghettos, within which they are 100% Muslim and within which they live by Sharia law. The national police do not even enter these ghettos. There are no national courts, nor schools, nor non-Muslim religious facilities. In such situations, Muslims do not integrate into the community at large. The children attend madrasas, and they learn only the Quran. To even associate with an infidel is a crime punishable with death, believe it or not. Therefore, in some areas of certain nations, Muslim imams and extremists exercise more power than the national average would indicate. And all this is adapted from Peter Hammond's book, Slavery, Terrorism, and Islam, the Historical Roots of the Contemporary Threat. Well, enough of this. Let's shift to another arena, and that's the collapse of Europe, okay? And obviously, you've all been reading in the predicament of Greece, the riots and so forth. I have a clip I'd like to show here on this one. That's another one of our... I'm just extracting this from our recent intelligence updates. Well, it seems that the United States is not the only country in the world struggling with immigration problems. Greece is confronting many of the same issues. Greece's remote Evros region has turned into Europe's main battleground against illegal immigration. More than two-thirds of the people making the clandestine journey into the European Union pass through here from neighboring Turkey. At least 21 people have drowned or died of exposure crossing the river this year, while several have been listed as missing. Greece has launched an aggressive campaign this month to try and seal its 200-kilometer border, even as it faces a financial crisis that has caused rampant unemployment and a surge of anti-immigrant demonstrations. In Athens, the operation is being bolstered by mass roundups of suspected illegal immigrants. They are seen lined up on the streets of the capital every day, many in handcuffs, waiting to be put in detention until they can be deported. Greece, like many EU governments, see deporting illegal immigrants as a matter of national survival. Uniformed police officers from 25 countries are already helping Greece guard the Evros River as part of the European Union's border protection program. Greek police figures show more than 21,000 illegal migrants were arrested in the first 6 months of the year 2012 after crossing over from Turkey, almost a 30% increase from the same period last year. Afghans currently make up the highest number of people crossing illegally, followed by Pakistanis, Bangladeshis, and an increasing number of people from war-ravaged Syria. This immigration crisis has brought out more than just an influx of immigrants. It has also brought out a shortage of Christian charity.
Go home, all of you. You are not wanted here. They are all thieves. They are full of diseases.
No. In Athens, for example, hundreds are going hungry during the economic crisis, but they are finding little help. The reason? They are immigrants. Quote, "We are providing food produced in Greece for Greek citizens only," close quote, said a spokesman for Greece's Golden Dawn, which is a far-right political party. Hundreds of people, mostly elderly, are waiting in line for some food on a street right outside the nation's parliament building. A line of workers wearing the Golden Dawn's trademark black T-shirts checked identification before giving the recipients a plastic bag filled with fruit, vegetables, and pasta. Golden Dawn is a newly emergent Greek party attacked by its opponents as being a neo-Nazi organization. It won 6.9% of June parliamentary elections and 18 seats, mostly in Athens. Golden Dawn's members include police officers, disaffected youth, and older people living in urban high-crime areas. The new economic austerity programs in Europe seem to have caused the rise of anti-immigrant sentiments in Greece, the Netherlands, Hungary, Finland, and other EU countries. This feeling of people losing their material wealth, combined with concerns over national culture and identity, seem to promote the rise of xenophobic political parties throughout Europe. Parties like the Golden Dawn play on those fears in an attempt to gain political power. Eerily reminiscent of Europe in the 1920s, mainstream parties struggle to convince voters that they understand their concerns and their distrust of social institutions. The voters, worried about being able to provide for themselves and their families, turn to extremist groups who claim they have the answers to their problems. Parties that were unknown a few years ago have grown in prominence with a message people wouldn't listen to when times were better. Desperate times can make for a desperate population.
Well, we could obviously go through charts and stuff about Greece, but they're pretty well covered in the press. In 2008, they lost 70% of their equity or larger. It's very likely they are going to default, despite attempts to prop them up. We could shift over to Spain and bore you with more charts and diagrams, much of the same flavor. But it's somewhat covered in the press if you're following that. So I'm going to shift gears here and give an assessment from another point of view out of Spain. An assessment out of Barcelona that was so poignant I had to just include it here, if I may. In the title of a little article called European Life in Europe Died in Auschwitz. And this was by Sebastian Villar Rodriguez, and it was translated from a Spanish newspaper. But he says, "I walked down the street in Barcelona and suddenly discovered a terrible truth. Europe died in Auschwitz. We killed 6 million Jews and replaced them with 20 million Muslims. In Auschwitz, we burned a culture, thought, creativity, talent. We destroyed the chosen people, truly chosen, because they produced great and wonderful people who changed the world. The contribution of this people is felt in all areas of life, science, art, international trade, and above all, as the conscience of the world. These are the people we burned. Under the pretense of tolerance, and because we wanted to prove ourselves that we were cured of the disease of racism, we opened our gates to 20 million Muslims who brought us stupidity and ignorance, religious extremism and lack of tolerance, crime and poverty due to an unwillingness to work and support their families with pride. They have turned our beautiful Spanish cities into the third world, drowning in filth and crime. Shut up in the apartments they receive free from the government, they plan the murder and destruction of their naive hosts. And thus, in our misery, we've exchanged culture for fanatical hatred, creative skill for destructive skill, intelligence for backwardness and superstition. We've exchanged the pursuit of peace of the Jews of Europe and their talent for hoping for a better future for their children, their determined clinging to life because it is holy, for those who pursue death, for people consumed by the desire for death for themselves and others,
for our children and theirs. What a terrible mistake was made by miserable Europe. Interesting assessment. It's, I think, far more telling than a few charts and graphs and so forth. But now I want to shift the time that we have left on another thing that may shock you. It's the, what shocks me, it's the biggest problem financially that you can find, and yet you can't find people who understand it. It's amazing the ignorance that surrounds this topic. We're going to attack it a very interesting way. I want to show you why the United States government cannot ever balance their budget. It's impossible. No matter who wins on November 6th, I'm not saying it's equal. That's a separate set of issues. But no matter who does win, the forthcoming implosion of America is certain. It's when, not if. I don't know if it'll be weeks or months, but it won't be long for an implosion to take place. And I'll show you why. There is no country that has a more intractable predicament. And I'll show you why. There are no citizens less able to deal with them. There's no population more uninformed or unprepared. Europe's got problems, but most Europeans are beginning to wake up to them and realize that what they're facing. And it's a lot of pain, a lot of problems. That's why there's riots. That's why there's all kinds of things. In the U.S., they're walking around blind, not realizing what's coming. We're going to go to the internet, and you will go on www.whitehouse.gov.omb for Office of the Manager Budget to budget. And that's what you'll see if you go there, okay? If you go down the left side there, there's the third one down is the budget. You clip on the budget, and you see, this is all we're going to do in effect here. And you get to the sheet called the budget. And we're going to work our way down to the bottom where there's a place called summary tables. And we're going to turn to that. And we're going to be on, we get to the summary tables. And we're going to go to page 210. And this is the proposed budget by category. This is the most important chart that you will see this weekend. We'll show you a lot of other things, but this one is the one that you want to earmark in your workbook. And we're going to look at just one column, and that's 2012. In other words, the current budget they're working on. If you look at the left-hand side there, there's the total outlays, the total money that the government spends in 2012. And that turns out to be about $3.8 trillion, okay? That's a bunch. If you look a little further down here, you have the tax, what goes in. And that turns out to be $2.5 trillion. So obviously there's more going out than coming in by a significant amount. That's the difference is called the deficit. And the deficit, the difference between those two numbers, is $1.3 trillion. Now the first thing you'll quickly discover if you get in any conversations, you'll discover that nobody knows what a trillion is. Not really. They'll give you a vague answer, but they don't have a grasp of what it is. Before we go any further, I want to just give you a little lesson in quantities. I want you to imagine that I owed you some money, and I'm going to pay you back. I tell you that I'm going to pay you back in a million seconds, 60 seconds to the minute and so forth, right? I'm going to pay you back in a million seconds. Well, you get out your calculator, and you quickly discover that's only 12 days. You can live with that. Oh, I'm sorry. I misspoke. I'll pay you what I owe you, not in a million, but in a billion seconds. So you get your calculator out and you discover a billion seconds. That turns out to be 32 years. See, my point is those are not just quantitatively different. They're qualitatively different. You could live with 12 days. There's no way you'd let me run for 32 years. You with me? But I explained quickly, oh, I'm sorry, I misspoke again. I didn't mean million or billion. I will pay you in a trillion seconds. And you quickly figure out that's 32,000 years. Now that may sound, you're going from million, billion to trillion is 12 days to 32 years, 32,000 years. Those numbers are gigantic. They go beyond anyone's grasp of reality.
Weathering the coming storm. And believe it or not, this new six-session briefing series with Dr. Chuck Missler and Ron Madsen is available on DVD and audio CD. If you'd like the full six-session briefing, give us a call here at 1-800 KHOUSE1, 1-800-KHOUSE, and then the number 1, and ask about the series Weathering the Coming Storm, either the series on DVD or on audio CD. 1-800-KHOUSE1, 1-800-KHOUSE, and the number 1. You'll also find it on our website, which has been for years, khouse.org, khouse.org, and we do have it available as a download. While you're at the site, don't forget you can sign up for our weekly e-news that comes to you free by email at khouse.org. And new listeners to the program are entitled to a year's free subscription to our monthly news journal, The Personal Update. All you have to do again is call us on our toll-free number, 1-800-KHOUSE1, 1-800-KHOUSE, and the number 1, and ask to be put on the free mailing list for the Personal Update magazine, which comes to your mailbox every single month. Tomorrow on the program, we'll continue the series, Weathering the Coming Storm. Do remember to pray for those suffering for their faith around the world, especially those inside the Islamic world. Pray for us here at Koinonia House. And until next time, on behalf of Dr. Chuck Missler and Ron Madsen, I'm John Leffler.